You've stopped in at the Guidepost, brought to you by the American Saltwater Guides Association. Stock up on gear, grab a coffee at the counter, and get ready to hear incredible fish stories from the best captains on the East Coast and thought-provoking conversations with stakeholders and policymakers working to protect these fisheries. This podcast is presented by Costa Sunglasses.
Hey, y'all. What you are about to listen to is one of the guest seminars from the 4th ASGA Fisheries Science Symposium that was hosted in May of 2025 at the Marine Biological Laboratory in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. ASGA Science Symposiums aim to foster a collaborative learning environment for industry leaders and guides and brand representatives and retailers, small business owners, media representatives, scientists, and even state representatives. And we were very proud with the crowd that came out and that we had a great representation of all those different categories of stakeholders for our fisheries. This year, we brought some new flair to the presentation topics. We focused on economics. There was a great talk about highly migratory species, and we even took a deep dive into great white sharks. And all three of our guest speakers were the top of their field, world-class, extremely interesting, and fielded a lot of great questions and Q&A sessions at the end. So without further ado, the audio to follow this intro is one of those guest speakers, and we owe a great deal of thanks to Sims Fishing Products. The Sims team has always been supportive of these symposium efforts and making sure that these events happen, that we're able to amplify good science and foster productive conversations. So a great deal of thanks to the Sims Fishing team, to the MBL staff, and to all those who attended our symposium. We present to you one of our guest speakers.
Let's welcome Greg Stommel from MassDMF. Greg is probably best known for his work on great whites, and I think anyone who's familiar with fishing around here or does fish around here a lot has noticed the relationship between the increase in seals and the increase in great whites. It's funny because, you know, obviously I like fish. So I actually first was introduced to Greg through all his books on aquariums. We're like on a Zoom, and I'm like, wait a minute. And I was thinking about Johnson. I'm like, oh my God, it's the same guy. And now so Greg has touched a lot of people with his research. We at the Guides Association, we try to, you know, I don't want to use some goof like organically and holistically, because I'm just not that kind of person, but you kind of look at the whole ecosystem, right? And kind of how to behave as fishermen, you know, to be a positive part of that ecosystem. And guess what? We are living with great white sharks here. So yeah. I want to thank Greg for coming down a lot. He's incredibly respected in his community, and him giving his time to us, we appreciate it. So without further ado, Greg, and also thank you for your Albie stuff. I can't.
Oh, no, I'm not, no.
Take away from everything. Thank you. We appreciate
Thanks,
that.
Tony.
You're legendary for that.
But I appreciate that, Tony. Thanks for inviting me. It's great to be here. I was on the podcast. Thanks for doing that. Thanks for everything, you know, the Guides Association does as well. Appreciate all the support you guys gave us during the Benito Albacore. That fell on my lap because although people tend to think of me as the shark person, I deal with all the highly migratory species issues in the state of Massachusetts for the agency, for the Commonwealth. So those small hardtails fall under HMS, and that fell on my desk. And I think we've had, you know, it took a couple of years, but we got it done. And I think Rhode Island and others are going to follow suit. So that was really good. I want to thank Chris.
That too.
Yeah. I think it's all good stuff that can come from that. And we did take into consideration, Ben, you know, the value of the commercial fishery. That was the first thing we did, and we found that it has little to no value in Massachusetts. A little different in other states, and that's what they're up against. But we certainly heard from your constituents that the value of these things is much higher to the recreational angler. But this afternoon you're going to hear a lot about HMS from Walt. Dr. Golay is here, so I will focus on white sharks and what's been happening and changing since this movie came out 50 years ago. And what's remarkable, this movie wasn't filmed all that far from here. And at the time, it led you to believe that, white sharks were everywhere and they ate human beings, and that's they had personal vendettas against people, and it was important for them to consume them. The truth is that at the time that Jaws was filmed, the great white shark was considered to be an extremely rare species. We called it, at the time, a rare event species. It's one that scientists could not predictably go out and find. And as a result, if science can't find a study species, you can't study it. And we knew very little about the great white shark in the North Atlantic Ocean, except for the fact that we had a number of sightings, records, and such. But as we trace history, just 4 years after that, a scientist from right here in Woods Hole at the Oceanographic Institution by the name of Frank Carey, pictured here with his brother, Frank's looking at the camera, was really an early pioneer in fish acoustic telemetry and even satellite tracking. Frank was building tags in his lab right here in Woods Hole that he used to track everything from bluefin tuna to swordfish to sharks, to get a glimpse into their natural history and how they behaved, as well as their physiology. Really well-known pioneer in physiological research on big fish. When you talk about bluefin tuna or white sharks or shortfin makos being warm-blooded, Frank was a pioneer when it came to discovering those aspects of their physiology. The most predictable way to find a great white shark, and even then it wasn't all that predictable, was to find a dead whale. And if you could find a dead whale, you could find white sharks sometimes feeding on them. So this is a photo of Frank putting one of his homemade tags, acoustic tags, into a great white shark for the first time in history on a global scale. And he followed it for 3 days, and he published this paper a few years later called Temperature and Activities of a White Shark, which in the scientific community was a landmark paper because no one had ever done this before with this species. And because white sharks, as a result of Jaws and other films and books, were considered to be an iconic species and potentially dangerous species, this paper got a lot of attention. So this is the actual published figures from the paper that came out in 1982. The upper right has the movements of that shark from basically the eastern end of Long Island out to Hudson Canyon over the course of these 3 days. And then because Frank built transducers, pressure sensors into his tags, he also had the three-dimensional movements of this animal, had the vertical movements of this shark. And one of the things that Frank talks about in the paper is we know so little about white sharks in the world, and specifically in the Atlantic, because we can't predictably go out and find them. And we can't go find them because many of the seal populations that you see in other parts of the world that draw the attention of white sharks had been diminished to very low levels here in the Western North Atlantic over the course of the last couple of hundred years. And as a result, this paper really remained as the only glimpse we had into the behavior and ecology of the white shark. In 1985, I was working for the National Marine Fisheries Service, having just come out of school at University of Rhode Island. I was working for a guy named Jack Casey, and this is Jack Casey pictured here. That's a very young Greg Skomel next to him. And Jack was a pioneer in conventional tagging of sharks, and he started the shark tagging program for the National Marine Fisheries Service in 1964. And he was working very, very closely with commercial and recreational fishermen to tag sharks, over 50 species on the Atlantic coast, including white sharks. And in early 80s, when Frank was, after he had tracked that fish with Frank Carey, he decided to compile with his colleagues everything we knew about where white sharks occurred in the Atlantic. And he came up with this basic figure, which shows that fisheries-dependent data. So basically, these are landings of white sharks by commercial and recreational fishermen dating back to as early as the early 1800s. So this is considered to be the historical distribution of the white shark. And it was really, in addition to what Frank published a couple of years earlier, what we knew about white sharks, period, in the North Atlantic. And you can see it seems to be a coastal species associated with the continental shelf, extending basically from the eastern side of the Gulf of Mexico all the way up the east coast of the U.S., right up into Canadian waters. And this persisted as state-of-the-art knowledge. But every now and then, working with Jack, one of these white sharks would come to him, or he'd go pick it up. And Frank and Jack was really the guy who taught me that you can learn a lot from a dead fish. And so we did a lot of necropsies in those days, and actually I still do to some extent. So some of these white sharks, this is a really small one. This is about the size we believe they are born, right up to some of the larger ones that were harpooned in the 80s. This is almost a 3,000-pound 17-foot male great white shark. So through these dissections, we were able to learn various aspects of their natural history. This is really traditional fisheries science, you know. If we want to know how many eggs a codfish has, you cut it open, you know. You guys look in the stomachs of your catch if you decide to keep one, you know. You want to know what they're eating, and fisheries biologists do the exact same thing. So I'm going to show you actually a necropsy of a white shark, and we just did this one last year. This shark beached itself in Orleans. On Dawson Beach. And this is a team of scientists with myself working up this and taking various tissues. And from the various tissues, you can learn about the basic biology of the natural history of the shark. So obviously, I'm looking at the stomach, right up to the reproductive system, male, female, mature, immature. We take a section of the backbone to get a sense by counting rings in it of the age of that shark. And others, various tissues that will help us learn about the biology of that animal. And just to give you an example of course, you know, I work for the state, so we don't work this fast. It's my classic joke with this one. At all. But just to give you an example of what you can get from these kinds of sampling, this is the growth curve for the white shark that Lisa Nate Tansen and I generated back in 2015 based on vertebral column samples that we took dating back to the ones Jack Casey sampled all the way back in the 60s. All right, and so by counting the rings in the vertebrae after sectioning it, you can see in the upper left-hand corner what the vertebrae looks like, the centrum looks like. You can count those rings, you can come up with a growth curve, and we found that the white shark is actually extremely slow-growing, living in excess of 70 years and not maturing until its late 20s and early 30s. So that's what you can learn from various kinds of tissue sampling. And we do it with everything from striped bass to codfish to you name it, right? It's just classic fisheries science. But it doesn't tell you much about the behavior, distribution, and movements, migrations of these animals. But I wasn't particularly focused on great white sharks for most of my career with the agency. And that career now spans almost 40 years. It wasn't until 2004 when a white shark swam into a salt pond on Nauchon Island, you know, less than a mile from here, that I started paying more attention to great white sharks. Fishermen's reports, whether it be charter captains or commercial guys, were telling me they think they were seeing more white sharks. And then this animal showed up, and we spent 2 weeks with this shark, and I put a very sophisticated satellite tag that had just emerged as a newer technology in those days on this shark. So this is a 14-foot female white shark that swam into this estuary and wouldn't leave for 2 weeks. And if you see at the base of her dorsal fin, as it goes by, you'll see the satellite tag right there. I'm sure Walt's going to talk about these tags. I'm going to touch on these tags as well. This was the latest greatest technology for tracking broad scale movements. I still use it quite a bit. Walt and his colleagues, they use it as well. Gives you nice broad scale movement patterns. We ultimately got that shark out of there, but it got me thinking about white sharks in terms of possibly coming back in greater numbers to our nearshore coastal areas. The other indication I had of that, of course, was the IFAW, or at those days, the Cape Cod Stranding Network in the early 2000s, calling me quite frequently during the summer and sending me photos like this. There's really only one critter that will do this to a large gray seal, and that is the white shark, and particularly along the outer eastward facing beaches of Cape Cod. These reports were coming in with greater frequency as we got into the 2000s. And I was thinking, all right, white sharks are coming back, obviously, in response to the growing seals population. And so a brief history on seals. You know, the general science points to the fact that they were once quite abundant throughout the northeastern U.S., primarily from the eastern end of Long Island all the way up to Canada. We had been harvesting seals over the course of several hundred years and had diminished those populations to near extinction levels. And then in 1972, we began protecting them. And as a result of now half a century of protection, we see seals in greater numbers. Well, the old line is, you know, if you show me a restaurant that looks like that, I'm going to show you their customers that will go to that restaurant. And that's exactly what's unfolding in Massachusetts and beyond now off our coastline. In response to the growing seal population, we're seeing white sharks not only in general come back in numbers as a result of protections put in place for them, but also shift their distribution closer to our coastal areas to feed on these seals. You know, and this basically occurs anywhere in the world. You show me large numbers of seals or sea lions that overlap with white shark distribution anywhere in the world, and I'll show you a hotspot for white sharks. And if you turn on, you know, the TV during Shark Week or where all the, any of these other programs, you will see, you know, films shot in those areas, you know, South Africa, Guadalupe Island, Mexico, Farallon Islands, California, South Australia. These are hot spots, and now Cape Cod. Now, this is the restoration of what we think is a natural ecosystem. You bring back lots of seals, you're going to get the natural predation, and ultimately that's the goal of conservation. What you don't count on in these situations is this, right? Overlap of top predators with humans that could result in shark attacks. And so I'll talk a little bit about shark attacks as we get into, actually I want to talk a lot about shark attacks and what we're doing to study these animals. That'll be the primary focus of this talk. But as a result, we've really intensified the tools and the technologies we're using to better understand the behavior of these animals. Because in the time period when the seals weren't here and the sharks weren't here, Cape Cod basically, you know, evolved from an agricultural community to one based on tourism, where people flock here from all over the world to enjoy our waters, whether it be to surf or to winds, you know, to kayak or to fish, right? And now we've got the restoration of this top predator overlapping with these activities. So the kinds of technology that we're using, and we started using back in 2009, were the satellite link tags, which I'll spend a little bit of time on, then the acoustic telemetry. And this really harkens back to what Frank Carey was building in his lab. And the way these tags work is they just emit a very high frequency sound. You know, Cody talked about the work being done, Ed's in the back of the room last year, he talked about the work being done on false albacore. That's acoustic technology. That's the same stuff that Frank Carey was using back in the 60s and 70s, except that the technology has improved dramatically in the sense that instead of following the fish around for 3 or 4 days, we set up acoustic receiver arrays that will detect those fish. Researchers are using them all the way from, you know, basically the Canada to the U.S. border in the Gulf of Mexico. So it's a great technology for looking at broad scale movements and as well as fine scale movements in residency and site fidelity, those kinds of things. And then I want to talk about the latest and greatest tags that we're using, which are basically camera systems built into tags that give us three-dimensional movement information. I'm not going to spend any time on drones, but to observe behavior, we've been using both underwater and topside, we've been using drone technologies as well. Many people have seen, because we're dealing with white sharks in Cape Cod, a lot of people have seen what we do on television. We get a lot of media coverage, some good, some bad. But our tagging technique is somewhat unique in the fact that we do not chum the waters off Cape Cod to draw sharks to us. That's a standard tagging technique that researchers use. I use it in other parts of the world. I use it when we're off of South Carolina trying to tag these animals. Instead of chumming the waters off our swimming beaches, we basically use a spotter pilot, commercial spotter pilot by the name of Wayne Davis, to show us where the shark is, and then we go in and we place our tags just like that on free swimming animals using a small intramuscular dart. It's the same exact technique that Jack Casey developed back in the 60s for conventional tagging of sharks. And before him, Frank Mather developed it for the conventional tagging of tunas and billfishes and such. So the placement of that intramuscular dart means we're not capturing the fish. We're not handling it. We're not dragging it through the water, tying it to the boat. Things I've done to sharks all over the world. I just don't want to do it off Cape Cod swimming beaches. I become, it's not a good thing for me, position for me to be in. I'm not very popular if I start doing that. So we've been able to use a variety of technologies from the standard acoustic tag right up to the satellite linked technologies. What I like about the technique is, you know, after we tag the shark, it basically resumes its what we think is its natural behavior. Typically, if you tag an animal by stress an animal out by excessively handling it, that animal is going to take off for a few days, you know, hours to days. Our sharks basically resume what they were doing. In most cases, they tend to hug the bottom. Sometimes they come to the surface, and that's when we're able to tag them. To date, we have tagged almost 400 individual white sharks ranging from 4 to 18 feet in length. These are the various technologies. I'm going to talk about each of them. The acoustic tags, almost because it's the least expensive and it's the most effective way for us to look at not only fine scale residency and behavior relative to Massachusetts, but also broad scale movements, we put out a lot of acoustic tags. These tags are very different from Frank's, because they last in excess of 9 to 10 years, okay? So these tags, you can track individual sharks or whatever you're tagging, you know, and I'm sure that Walt's going to talk about other species this afternoon. You know, whatever you're tagging, you could track individuals for multiple years to look at changes in behavior over time, and then relative to environmental conditions that might also be shifting over time. For broad scale movements, I tend to focus on the pop-up satellite tag, although there are tags we call spot tags that can be mounted to the dorsal fin of the white shark, and you could track its movements when it comes to the surface. Now, because fish don't require air to breathe, not all of them come to the surface, and not all of them come to the surface for long enough periods of time to transmit to a satellite. So I tend to favor the pop-up satellite tag, which will stay on the shark for a programmable amount of time, up to about a year. While it's on the shark, it's archiving depth and temperature and light level data. And then at a time programmed by us, it comes to the surface, it pops off the animal, transmits to a satellite, and we're able to rebuild, do a retrospective analysis on what that shark did. And then, of course, we've put out almost 50 behavior tags of these camera tag systems. People ask me all the time, where do you see white sharks on Cape Cod? My answer is always, where do we not see white sharks along the outer Cape? But of course, look at this and realize that it is fisheries biased. It's biased data. It's effort dependent data. It's biased data. We don't spend a tremendous amount of time in Cape Cod Bay. And when we are, we see them basically on the flats, Brewster Flats and Billingsgate Shoal. We don't spend any time in Nantucket Sound, and almost all of our effort is between P-Town and the southern tip of Monomoy, and that's where we see sharks. So this would be a biased data set if I said this was the distribution of the white shark in the state of Massachusetts. We'll get an unbiased estimate when we look at our tagging data. You know, what are the tags telling us relative to our acoustic array? When we first started tagging these sharks in 2009, 10, 11, 12, I was super interested in the big picture in terms of three-dimensional movements of these animals. And so that's where the satellite link tags started to reveal to us these broad-scale movements that they were doing. This is actually a shark we tagged off of South Carolina just 2 years ago, and it moved all the way up into the Gulf of Mexico, all the way to the Mexican border. And then back up the eastern seaboard of the U.S., it popped into the first Burger King on I-95, which is Cape Cod, and then kept going all the way up into the Gulf of St. Lawrence. You know, so that's just one animal over the course of about a year and a half. What's really neat about these pop-up satellite tags is that they give you three-dimensional information, so you know the depth and the temperature of that individual. Now, the resolution associated with the horizontal movements, I mean, where that animal is latitudinally, longitudinally, are fairly coarse and have a lot of error associated with them. But you can combine them with other technologies like the acoustic technology to get a better sense of where those animals actually are. This is a really small white shark that we tagged off the southern side of a Long Island Island a couple of summers ago, and I think it's a wonderful animation that gives you a sense of the kinds of information you get from these individual tags. Now, these pop-up satellite tags will only last up to about a year. I tend to program them for 8 months because, you know, you throw electronics in the ocean and they don't always work. And so I tend to go with shorter durations than the full year. And then just to give you a sense of the kinds of movements data, a number of white sharks, smaller white sharks, have been tagged on the south side of Long Island. I just showed you one. These are the larger animals we've tagged off of Cape Cod. And you can see they move throughout, you know, Massachusetts Bay, offshore, out into the Great South Channel. What's interesting is they don't spend much time at all moving to the west, you know, where they have the potential to interact with the smaller white sharks. So they seem to segregate from the smaller animals, which are in those areas that we consider to be the nurseries. But it gives you a sense of how you can look at the broad scale movements using this technology as it relates to the oceanography as well. What we didn't count on, as I said earlier when we started tagging these animals, and it really got us to shift our focus a little bit. As we emerged from doing the broad scale migration work, we started thinking about in terms of numbers of white sharks. So working with Megan Winton through the School for Marine Science and Technology at UMass, where my office is down in New Bedford, she came up with the first population estimate for white sharks occurring off the coast of Cape Cod, and that estimate was about 800 sharks visited that area over the course of a 4-year period. We also didn't count on, well, that gave us a sense, and public safety officials a sense of relative risk, right? And then, of course, we had a series of events that were basically attacks by white sharks on people. Prior to 2012, the last fatal shark attack on a swimmer in Massachusetts was in Buzzards Bay, that little green dot, back in 1936. All right. Since then, though, we had virtually nothing for 86 years until 2012, when a swimmer was bitten off of Truro. Then in 2014, we had kayakers off Plymouth whose kayak literally was knocked up into the air, big bite mark in the kayak. Fortunately, the kayakers were not injured, but they had to swim there for 15 minutes waiting for assistance. A couple years later, in 17, we had a paddleboarder whose paddleboard was bitten off Newcomb Hollow Beach in Wellfleet. And then in 2018, we had two attacks, one in August, one in September. The first one was non-fatal on a swimmer, close to fatal, and then the second one on a boogie boarder was fatal. You know, and a fatal shark attack is different, very different, in terms of how a community reacts to the presence of this species, and it rippled throughout the community. And we realized that the big picture stuff we were doing relative to the movements of this animal, we need to focus a little bit more on better understanding how this shark was swimming and behaving when it was in Massachusetts. And so we started beefing up our use of acoustic telemetry. And remember, this is the same technology basically that Frank Carey used back in 1979, except that we put the tag on the shark or whatever species we're studying, and that array of acoustic receivers, which you see with little yellow dots right here, when the shark swims within the range of one of those receivers, the receiver will detect who that shark is, the serial number of that shark, and then record the date and the time that shark was there. So assuming I have a sufficient array of receivers throughout Massachusetts, I can get a relative sense of where these animals are spending their time. You know, with the number of with the fatality in 2018, I really wanted to focus more on when the sharks were here, and when they left, and where do they spend their time, and how do they feed on seals? What triggers a natural predatory event? Because most of us in the scientific community believe that if a white shark bites a person, it's a mistake. Otherwise, we'd have a heck of a lot more. And to give you a sense of the seasonal timing and where these animals are occurring in Massachusetts, these are two sets of data. one from 22 and one from 23. Number of detections, right, which is now numbering over a million from the 300 plus sharks that we've tagged, relative to time of year. And you can see a very distinct seasonality. You know, when surfers come to me and say, when are the sharks not here? I'll say basically from December into through April. All right, and then they start to trickle in May, but in such low numbers, they don't even show up on these graphics. And there are subtle changes from year to year, right? Likely driven by water temperature and other factors. But here you can see in 2022, August, September, and October, those are the three peak months. They typically are the three peak months. Same with in 2023, with more animals here in October. In more detections in October in 23. And then, of course, we can look at where these detections are. And although my data set relative to tagging was biased, it did reflect, in essence, the greatest abundance of white sharks in terms of numbers of detections. And here you can see that the Outer Cape, basically from P-Town all the way down to Monomoy, is where the greatest numbers for both years occur, with as you move into Cape Cod Bay, the numbers drop off. And then as you get up the coastline toward Boston and then into the Gulf of Maine, you really have animals that are just transiting the area. All right. The only stop they seriously make is off Plymouth, where there's a small seal haul out. If you don't have big numbers of seals like you do here, you're not going to hold the attention of white sharks. Manamet Point in Plymouth in 2023 had a lot of seals throughout in that summer, and that drew the attention of white sharks. Otherwise, they're largely traversing in the area. For those of you who fish Cape Cod Bay, you know that Jeremy Point has a haul out of seals. You can see that emerges as a hot spot. It's the seals they're after, and they're going to spend their time where the seals are spending the most time as well. If the seals move out, the sharks will generally move out. They're transient, trying to get to those seal resources. One of the things we did back a few years ago, Megan and I, was we combined two data sets. We took our acoustic tags, which told us where the sharks, when the sharks were close to shore, right? And then we took the data collected by a satellite tag on that same animal, right? And those data, of course, were depth data as well as temperature data. So what you see here is eight different individuals over the course of a month each, right? Eight individuals for 1 month period of time. When you see an X, that shark is close to shore on Cape Cod in one of our acoustic arrays. And what you see here are the depths of these animals. So they're basically moving between the surface and down to 25 meters. But every now and then a shark will dive down, will go head offshore and head out to 100 meters, you know, 300 feet depths of water, you know, but for the most part, they stay relatively shallow. This is the distribution of depths for each one of those individuals. And by modeling these data sets, you know, and again, the goal being to try to produce information to enhance public safety, we found out that the white sharks, for the most part, spend almost half their time in water less than 15 feet deep when they're off of Cape Cod. So if you manage the Wellfleet beaches, and when I tell this to the lifeguards there or the beach managers, they go, huh, what? Yeah, almost 50% of their time in the shallow waters overlapping with human activities. We're trying to educate public safety officials to give them a relative sense of risk. You know, and then the other thing we're trying to do is to directly and indirectly observe predatory behavior so we can better understand how these sharks are actively preying on seals. Is there some kind of environmental factor, you know, some biological or even non-biological factor that drives a predatory event from start to finish, all right? We have direct observations. Here's a case where our spotter pilot, Wayne, you know, big blood spot in the water. We shoot over there. We collect as much information as we can relative to depth, time of day, water temperature, lunar phase, you name it. We collect as much information about each one of those predatory events so that we can quantify what might be driving them. There are instances. Now, if you turn on the TV and you see air jaws, you see white sharks launching themselves out of the water. That is typical behavior in South Africa. We do not see a lot of breaching behavior in Massachusetts because the water is a lot shallower, but we do occasionally see it. So I'm going to show you a few instances of breaching behavior that we've captured on video. This first one is a white shark that was staying probably about 50 feet off the beach, moving back and forth, and the smart seals stay in the shallows, okay? We were watching this shark from the boat. I had a GoPro camera running, and a seal that didn't get the memo came swimming from offshore under our boat and swam right into this white shark. So what you're gonna see is the video I shot of what happened next. Now I'll zoom in and I'll slow it down, but basically this seal encountered the shark and there was very little it could do other than go straight up in the air, and that's what you'll see first. The seal coming up and the shark following it with its mouth wide open trying to get the seal. And of course, you see no blood, so the seal got away and it made it to the shoreline and never went back in the water again. But so that was an instance where, you know, the shark in with, you know, these are ambush predators. But this shark saw its prey, and even though it saw its prey and it was literally just a few feet away, that seal was able to elude the shark because the seal saw the shark. You know, if the shark can't ambush the seal generally wins, you know, that particular move. So here's an instance where actually a shark breached while I was trying to videotape it. So here I am on the pulpit of our tagging vessel, and Wayne Davis is flying up above, and he's telling me there's a white shark in this general area. We're not far from the beach, but the water is basically coffee. It's tea. And so I can't see the shark. So you're going to hear the spotter pilot talking to the captain, and I can hear him, and he's telling me where it is. And look underneath my feet. Right under my bow. Here we go again. Mouth wide open. Neat little dance, eh? Went right back to work, okay? Not the typical, not your typical state employee. All right. So that's one of those breaches I don't want to see again. But when we do, like I said, when we do see a white shark that is consuming a seal, we collect as much information as we possibly can. This is a great example. I used to use grad students for this, but thank God for GoPro cameras have taken their place. The shark is really trying to tear off that really thick blubber layer, all right? And that's what sustains this animal. If it can't eat the whole seal, it'll go for the blubber. Same as if you've got a dead whale. Who's ever seen a dead whale being fed upon by whale? It's really neat to watch. You know, these sharks come right up on that whale, and they're ripping out massive hunks of flesh. But we can't be everywhere all the time, so it's very difficult for us to get direct observations because, you know, we're not out at night. We don't know what's going on at night, and we wouldn't see anything, right? We're not, you know, you got 50 miles of Cape Cod, right? I can't be everywhere all the time, and these events happen very, very, very quickly. So we've been trying to use a number of indirect methods to study behavior of these animals so that we don't have to be out there. And one of them we're doing with the Center for Coastal Studies and a student by the name of Brian Laguerre, who's a biologist there. And what you see here are five locations where we've set up really fine scale acoustic arrays. And all that means is we've taken the receivers that we use, we put them so close together that when the shark swims through the area, we can triangulate exactly where it is and get a sense of what its behavior is relative to the environment. Because at the same time, we're also mapping that habitat to get a sense of the bathymetry and collecting information on everything from movement of currents and tidal cycles, you name it, water temperature. So we're taking those environmental correlates and trying to see if the behavior of these individual animals is associated with any of them. And we don't have to be there. So here's a great example of the array we set up off of Head of the Meadow. And what you see here are each one of those triangles is an acoustic receiver really close together, and then the colors correspond to the bathymetry in the area. And you can see this is an area where we've got a double sandbar system, which is typical of a lot of Cape Cod. So now we can look at the movements of individual sharks through this area. This is one shark that is in this area. You can see the dual sandbars, and you can see the acoustic receivers in black dots. And these are the actual tracks of an individual shark that moved through that virtual positioning array that we've set up. So you now look at the behavior as it relates to all these environmental conditions. So when I show this again to public safety officials and lifeguards, I tell them, you know what your beach looks like, low tide, high tide, know where those deep troughs are. Remember, ambush predators. Seal sees the shark, seal wins. Shark's gonna stay in these deep troughs, hanging out, waiting for a seal to screw up, all right? Waiting for a seal that leaves that beach to go offshore and feed, because actually the seal has to, and that shark is there. So if you're a swimmer, pay attention. Pay attention to these areas. So that's the kind of information we can get from these kinds of arrays. And again, we can look at this day versus night, right? So it's not necessarily, we're not locked into the time we're on the water. Another technique is I mentioned these camera tag systems, and I'll wrap things up with that because I know you guys want to go to lunch. We've put out over almost 50 of these now. What's really cool about these tags is they have sensors in them that give us information on how that animal is moving through the water, okay? So is it turning right? Is it turning left? Going up, going down? It measures this information 20 times per second. So really fine scale behavior. And we can look at those different behavioral states as demonstrated in the data and see what they mean by comparing it to what we actually see recorded by the camera system. This is really fairly unique behavior. This is a white shark, and if you look at the bottom here, the bottom's not changing much. It turns out this shark hadn't fed all that long ago and was just kind of hanging out, orienting into the current so it can continue to breathe, right? And just resting. So this was resting behavior, and the data we collected by the tag, we have a signature of what that looks like now, right? This is really cool behavior. We named this shark Snoop Dogg because of this behavior. This shark is eating spiny dogfish. All right, so this shark is swimming in about 30 feet of water just off of Cape Cod. It's moved offshore, and we know that from our other data, these sharks will occasionally do that. They'll move out into 200 to 300 feet of water in cases. You're gonna see every now and then the camera go nuts, and that's the shark taking off to scoop up a dogfish. And if you look really close at its mouth, you'll see every now and then one of those dogfish wiggle. And I've got a screen grab of that in a second. But these are short bursts in order to scoop up dogfish, right? And we knew from some of the gut contents work we had done years ago, there's the tail of a dogfish, that these sharks will consume dogfish, and they like the smaller shark species. There's the tail of a dogfish. And I think I have, there's the head of a dogfish that's met its demise. So these are the kinds of behaviors that we're seeing. And this is my favorite. This is an actual breach of a white shark that has a camera tag on it. And I'll show you what it's like in at normal speed. The shark's just cruising along. It sees something at or near the surface and decides to go and attack it from deep water. And now I will slow that down so that you get a better sense of the view from the tag as this shark decides to accelerate, probably to speeds in excess of 15 to 20 miles an hour. Shark coming out of the water, doing a complete flip, and back into the water, right? So these are the kinds of behaviors. And so if we look at the data sets generated by these tags, and this is an actual attempt at a seal, all right? Who's rooting for the shark? Probably everybody. Everybody's rooting for the shark, come on. We've all had bass stolen by seals. We know, we're all rooting for the shark. All right, here's another one of those scenarios where you've got smart seals staying shallow enough the shark can't get to it, and you got the frustrated shark. And this shark has a camera tag on it. Now, this shark decides that I don't care. I'm going right into the surf zone, right on the beach, and I'm going to try to attack and kill a seal. And you look at the water breaking here, all right? This is a risk for the shark. It also has to accelerate, and it'd be like us sprinting. After we sprint, we need to rest. This shark is going to sprint, mobilize all its muscle to blast into the shoreline and try to kill this seal. And it looks like it's going to get it, right? So what do we see in the camera? Shark just kind of slowly lurking, sneaking into the shallows. You can see the beautiful crystal clear water of Cape Cod. Every now and then you'll see you will see some of the bottom. Now, because it's a towed camera system, it goes berserk when the shark accelerates, right? And so now you can see the shark really starting to pick up its speed because it's in hot pursuit of the seal into the surf zone. Remember, this is a massive expenditure of energy for the shark. So if it doesn't pay off, that animal is at a net loss, all right? From a bioenergetic point of view, if it continues to lose these fights, it has to do something else to make a living. And so I think that's actually what happens with some sharks. They come to Cape Cod and realize that the drive-up window is not as easy as it looks, and they take off and go to the Gulf of Maine and may feed on something else. Now, this shark just blew a bunch of energy, and now it's heading out into deeper water to start to mellow out and relax and repay that oxygen debt and adjust its internal chemistry and payback. And so when we look at that, you know, we can recreate that from the data sets collected by the tag. You know, remember, we know what this shark's doing multiple times per second, right? So we can recreate that three-dimensional attack phase from the data set alone. And we're not there. We don't have to be there. And we can look at this, again, day versus night. We can look at all kinds of different parameters related to the predatory event itself. And this is, seal sees the shark. The seal typically will swim around to the tail of the shark if it's not close to shore. And then if it's close to shore, shoot up straight on the beach. So just to give a sense collectively of what we've been able to achieve, you know, since 2009, remember, for many years, Frank Carey's track from Long Island to Hudson Canyon was state of the art. This is what we knew. This was the glimpse we had into the biology of the white shark in the western North Atlantic in 1979. If we fast forward to the paper by Casey and Pratt in 85, we believed it was a coastal species. We thought we captured, historically at least, where this shark was. And now if I take the data from all my tags, and this was over 600 data points, I've now got well over 2 million data points. And this is the actual distribution of the great white shark in the western North Atlantic. And what's really neat is, you know, yes, those green dots, which are largely acoustic detections, show that it is indeed a shelf-oriented species. There is also this oceanic phase that larger white sharks, predominantly females, exhibit. And when they go out, you know, into the open Atlantic, they shift their vertical behavior, so they begin to dive, right? So this is the shark when it's on the shelf. You know, it leaves the shelf, it leaves Cape Cod in early December, and then it moves out into the open Atlantic off the shelf and dives at depths as great as 3,000 feet, you know, almost every day through a really broad temperature range, right? And, you know, white sharks aren't the only things that do this. And maybe Walt will show some of this later, but, you know, everything from billfish to bluefin tunas to other species of sharks exhibit this deep diving behavior in oceanic habitat. You know, some people, there's a lab on the West Coast who believes that these animals are moving out there, you know, to reproduce, to mate. I don't believe that. Why would you leave a perfectly good pub in Cape Cod where there's boys and girls to go out to the middle of nowhere and try to find a mate? Doesn't make sense to me. I think they're feeding on squid out in those oceanic areas. So stay tuned. The work continues as we try to unravel the secrets of this animal. If you're interested in seeing any of our data, we put it up on the Sharktivity app run by the Atlantic White Shark Conservancy. Which is free, and then we have the logbook, which shows our actual acoustic detection data. So if you live in Duxbury, you want to see how many detections are on our Duxbury receiver, yada, yada, yada. Then we've got the White Shark catalog, which has at least 700 plus individual animals that we have identified off of Cape Cod. And with that, I will thank a whole bunch of organizations, specifically Atlantic White Shark Conservancy, for all their support over the years. And I'll advertise selflessly my books, which are not the aquarium books, Tony, but they're still out there, including saltwater aquariums for dummies, you know? So the dummy wrote the dummy book. And with that, I know we're up against lunch, but a question or two maybe, and or see me at lunch.
Yeah, good. Y'all, the Woods Hole people are saying we gotta eat lunch now because they don't want the lunch to go bad. So we're gonna break like 30 minutes. If you go out right here and just walk out the door, you'll see a tent set up. Make sure you have your little lovely little blue wristband. You can grab lunch, and we'll be right back in here, let's say, in like 30 minutes. Thank you so much, Greg.
Thank you. Thanks, guys.
We love some stuff. Like, asking questions, talking to lunch, but...